He jumps onto the collapsed chaise lounge and we both stare at the escaped animal. It's a Boston Terrier with two pointed black ears and a white streak of fur down the middle of its forehead that runs over its chin and chest. It looks up at him expectantly. Travis gives me a sheepish smile.
It's Wolverine-like,
I say charitably. He exhales loudly and steps back down, then kneels to scoop up the small dog.
Hey, guy, he says, scratching its neck. What are you doing in here?
The dog nips his finger, and Travis cries out and drops it, falling back on one hip. The terrier runs around in a tight circle.
Oh my gosh, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, says Isabella's voice.
I look around, then back at the dog, confused. Realization quickly dawns.
No.
Unfortunately, yes,
comes Isabella's voice again through the Boston Terrier's muzzle.
When I was running out after you, they zapped me. Will I stay this way forever? I mean, I've always joked about how nice it'd be to trade lives with a dog, sleeping all day and living in complete bliss. But it kind of feels like I'm a prisoner in a dog-shaped flesh prison.
Travis looks at me with wide eyes. By this point, nothing surprises me.
Isabella, relax.
Oh, sorry, I didn't mean for that to sound so much like a command, I say.
You try relaxing after interspecies transformation. I'm a dog.
She starts swatting at Travis's leg repeatedly with her paw.
That's really annoying, he says. But I guess it could have been worse. Everyone likes dogs, right?
We both look at Travis. Seriously? I ask. I turn to Isabella.
It'll be okay. We'll get you back to being yourself.
Please tell me you've got the spell book,
Isabella says. Her face is so expressive, even as a dog, that I can almost see the real Isabella staring back at me, chewing on her lip with worry.
Seriously? Yes, I have the spell book,
Travis says, waving it. She wiggles her stubby tail without answering and whimpers.
So, I think we should get to the graveyard before the Sanderson sisters come back for us,
says Travis.
Didn't you say that's hallowed ground, Poppy?
What?
Yeah,
yes, I say in a daze.
Come on, let's go,
Isabella says. What about my parents? I ask, but Isabella is bounding through the door.
Poppy, we're smart. We're capable. We can get them back. Together. Trust me. But first, we need to come up with a game plan. Now, come on!
She calls over her shoulder.
Travis is right. We'll be safer in the graveyard.
This night keeps getting weirder and weirder. Travis and I hurry to keep up.
Oh, I get it. A Boston Terrier. Because we're in Massachusetts. Do you get it?
Travis says to me. I give him a withering look.
Seriously? Not the time.
When we pass through the gate, I spot my parents' dark sedan parked on the street outside the Sanderson house, partially hidden by some overgrown bushes. Travis is already there, racing around and testing the handles on each door of the car.
Locked, he says. They must have had the keys with them when they...
His voice trails off in a way that makes my heart ache even more. We push on to the graveyard. It's still and silent, just like before. But the tombstones take on a more ominous air with my family missing. When I shut the gate behind us, I realize that my hands are trembling. The full weight of the situation hits me all at once.
Oh, God,
I mutter, running a hand through my hair.
Oh, my God, you guys, what am I going to do?
The image of my parents and Aunt Danny, their faces frozen in a moment of shock, dances in front of my eyes just out of reach. I stop to catch my breath and end up crouching with my head against my bent knees and my hands on the top of my scalp.
Oh, my God, what have we done?
Poppy, we had no way of knowing that any of this was even real, says Isabella. It's not your fault. We'll get them back.
I shake my head. I wanted to come down here, and I read that stupid spell that Winifred's spellbook fed to us.
I should have listened to my parents. They were right. I'm an idiot.
I feel a rush of hot blood to my face. Travis gives me a worried look.
We can still be spotted from the road.
I bite my bottom lip and shake my head, barely believing any of this.
He walks over and helps me back to my feet, and together we follow Isabella deeper into the damp, dark cemetery.
Why did this happen? I ask Isabella. Why did the spellbook find you? Why did it work? Do you know something we don't?
Last week, she explains, my parents gave me a DNA test. They thought it would be cool for me to learn more about our ancestors and stuff. Our family history as Richardses, that sort of thing. This week, the results came in, and I learned a ton. Like, there's a whole line of us in Louisiana who I never knew about. And you can trace my DNA back to both Ghana and Nigeria. She hesitates. I was surprised to learn that my 8th great-grandmother was born in Salem. But she moved south more than 300 years ago. And her mom was Elizabeth Sanderson.
That's why you asked about her in class, I say, realization dawning. That's why the book found you.
Isabella nods. I think you may be right.
But why now? I ask. You've lived in Salem for years.
Isabella frowns, considering. No idea, she says. Your guess is as good as mine.
So what? You're a witch? Asks Travis.
Isabella plops down and gives her neck a scratch with her hind leg.
Sorry, having four legs is exhausting, she says. Who knows what I am? Right now, I'm a dog. But I thought being related to the Sandersons was this cool, kind of interesting thing, you know? Some fun fact I could use as an icebreaker? And I was going to tell you, but I kind of wanted to know more about Elizabeth first. You know, if she was actually a good witch, unlike her sisters.
Okay, so you're a Sanderson and a witch, maybe. And the Sanderson sisters are back. But I didn't see Elizabeth. And my mom and dad and aunt are in hell. What was the spell we read exactly? I say.
Travis crouches low and opens the spell book. And Isabella sticks a paw on the page.
Here, she says. Swap souls? What does that even mean?
He says before reading the rest of the page.
It says that, basically, souls of the living are swapped for souls in the beyond.
This isn't happening, I say, as if saying it can somehow make it true. I turn away from both Travis and Isabella and find my legs carrying me farther up the hill. I can see the cemetery chapel from here. It looks even smaller in the dark. The bell is barely visible, the curve of its top throwing off a sliver of moonlight.
We have to get to higher ground, I call numbly back to Travis and Isabella. And out of the trees, if the witches find brooms, we can see them coming.
That's another lesson I learned from my family. Aunt Fanny only got snatched up by Winifred because she wasn't paying attention and didn't see the witch swoop down out of the trees. I sink onto the chapel's low-slung porch and drop my face into my hands.
What are we going to do?
I feel the fear creeping over me, gaining leverage, crushing the breath from my chest. I inhale deeply and release the air slowly, trying to formulate a plan.
But what do you do when your family is in hell and evil witches are on the loose, hunting you down?
Travis sits down next to me and puts one hand on my knee and his other arm around my shoulders.
It's gonna be okay, he says.
That's when the tears start coming, spilling hot and salty down my face. When I open my mouth to breathe, I taste them on my dry lips.
My parents, I say. Aunt Danny.
I know,
he whispers, holding me tighter. My whole body shakes. Isabella comes over and places her paws on the toe of my boot.
We're in this together. Poppy, you're one of the smartest and bravest people I know. We got this.
Above us, the church bell begins to clang of its own accord. I feel Travis and Isabella tense, and I take a deep breath.
Pull it together, Dennison, I think.
The three of us wait for the bell to quiet. At this point, I can't even bring myself to be afraid of it. I replay dropping my camera in the Sanderson house. That's the least of my worries. As the last toll dies, Isabella sits up straighter.
Poppy, it's okay, she says.
It's not okay.
I wipe tears from my face, angry at myself for crying. and angry that I didn't listen to my mom and did something stupid. My family is in hell. You're a dog.
Travis opens the spellbook again and studies the page as Isabella sits down beside him.
Wait, Isabella says. There, in the book. It says the spell breaks at sunrise.
I blink at them through stinging eyes.
What? The spell says, on All Hallows' Eve, ere 12 is struck, trade 3 souls until sunup. Once the sun comes up, everything will go back to normal.
I sit up straighter, the lightness of hope rising in my chest at the thought of this nightmare ending at dawn. I never really believed my parents' stories about that weird Halloween night when they saved Salem and fell in love, but I always thought that if it were real, I wouldn't have been nearly brave or creative enough to do the things they did, like embarrassing themselves in front of everyone at the town hall party, or torching the witches in the arts wing. If I have to accept that all this is real, the fact that the spell will break at dawn seems too good to be true. But I say, well, that's reassuring.
And you heard the witches? Not a lot happens in hell, apparently.
Your parents should be safe and sound in the meantime, says Isabella.
Hopefully,
she adds in a tentative voice.
Yeah, says Travis, closing the spell book. But I don't think those 3 witches are here for a one-night joyride. Last time they tried to eat kids, Poppy.
No matter what, we can't let them get the spellbook back, I say. As long as we have the spellbook, we have all the Sanderson spells, and if this spell breaks at sunrise, we only have to keep them distracted for a few more hours before they get sent back to hell and my family comes back to us. I look at Isabella. And you're sure about this?
I'm sure, says Isabella. But if you could help me figure out how not to be a dog anymore, that'd be cool.
Of course, I tell her, drying my face. But another voice, a voice I don't recognize, interrupts our conversation.
It's all not quite that simple, I'm afraid.
The 3 of us turn to our left. 2 figures, a small girl and a much taller boy, are striding around the side of the chapel. They're both pearlescent, their flowy clothes and pale skin emanating warm amber light. I've never seen them before, but from Mom and Dad's descriptions, I feel like I know them.
Binks? I ask, shocked.
Travis stands up next to me, wide-eyed and sputtering, not quite managing to form complete words. The boy inclines his head.
Hello, Poppy, he says. I'm guessing your dad's no longer a virgin.
Gross, I say. He tosses 2 keys on a key ring. The keys to the Sanderson gate and house on the ground.
We tried to warn you to turn back, he says. But looks like the hint didn't really materialize for you.
Squad Ghouls. Thackeray Binks's ghost appraises us, some of his floppy hair falling in his eyes, the rest pulled back in a small ponytail. Emily stands beside him, smiling serenely.
Hello, friends, she says.
Nothing's creepier than a child ghost, except for 2 child ghosts, though Thackeray, a.k.a. Binks, looks a good 5 years older than her, at least. Emily's blonde hair is covered by a white cap, and her matching nightgown stops just above her toes. I can see the woods through both of their filmy bodies. The Sandersons' appearance made it clear that my family story is true, but meeting Binks and Emily is another thing entirely. I've heard so much about them, especially Binks, that it's like meeting my parents' childhood friends for the first time.
Ghosts!
Travis hisses urgently to me.
Pops, there are ghosts!
You knew there were ghosts, I hiss back. I've told you the story.
Yeah, but I didn't believe it.
Well, neither did I.
I shake my head, stand up, and take a step closer to Binks and his sister.
How do you know my name?
You're a Denison. You're practically famous in ghost circles. Anyway, when we saw you approaching the house this evening, with the spell book in her bag,
he looks at Isabella.
We had a feeling you took after your dad. Speaking of which, Max, Allison, and Danny arrived in hell not long ago and asked me to keep a close eye on you 3. We were able to speak with spirits on either side of the veil after all.
My family, are they okay?
I ask desperately. Binks nods.
But not for long, he says. I'm afraid the spell book's logic isn't as straightforward as you say. The spell does not expire when the sun rises. It becomes permanent.
Permanent? Asks Isabella, surprise and fear in her voice.
Permanent dogs, Travis says. Permanent ghosts. It sounds like we're friggin' permanently screwed.
Well, says Binks, crouching to get a better look at Isabella.
Aren't you a funny little thing? I guess the Sanderson witches didn't want a wily black cat around anymore, so they made you a cute, simple puppy instead.
I am not simple, Isabella protests.
Don't worry, says Binks, patting her on the head. I was only a cat for 300 years. It worked itself out. Eventually.
She stares at him, appalled. I don't understand, I break in. Permanent? Meaning my family will never come back?
It will be permanent, says Banks, unless you can find the Blood Moonstone and destroy it in time.
Travis's face lights up.
Blood Moonstone? We overheard the witches talking about that, he says to me. They said they were going to look for the Blood Moonstone and their spellbook.
What's a Blood Moonstone? I ask. It's a magical item hidden in Salem, says Emily serenely, but no one knows where.
Great! And we have no clue where the Blood Moonstone is, says Isabella. Now we definitely can't let them get back their spellbook.
I look at Binks and Emily, unable to process what to do next. Why are you still in the graveyard? My parents said you'd crossed over that night.
The veil is a bit permeable, says Binks with a smile. At least for those of us who are needed.
I crouch and pick up the keys that unlock the Sanderson gate and house, then stand back up. The metal is still cool from Binks's hand. As if the keys have been sitting in the refrigerator. I pocket them. Are you sure my family's okay? My voice sticks in my throat. Emily walks over, though her feet never seem to touch the ground, and Travis and Isabella step aside as she kneels in front of me. Her face is small and angelic, the linen cap keeping her hair out of the way.
Wouldst thou like to speak with them?
She asks sweetly. Well, I trust Binks and Emily. I'd still like to see my family with my own eyes. Besides, the three of them defeated the Sanderson sisters before. They'll know what to do now. As I realize this, a swell of hope washes over me, warm and comforting. Yes, I say, leaning toward the ghost girl. Please? Emily holds out both her hands, palms up. Here, she says with a nod. Travis and Isabella watch me, and Travis nods encouragingly. I place my hands on Emily's. Her skin feels real, and yet not. If I hold still, her hands seem cool and solid, as if carved from wood. But when I move, my own hands seem to slip through hers just slightly, with little resistance. I shiver.
Do not be afraid, she says with a childish lilt in her voice.
Binks comes and places a hand on her shoulder. At first, I think he's going to ask her to get up and leave me alone. But his dark eyes meet mine.
Close your eyes, Poppy Dennison.
He says gently. When I close my eyes, the glow of Emily's face seems to follow me into the dark.
Clear your mind,
Binks murmurs. His voice is serious and soothing. Yeah, I'll get right on that. I only have to clear a million spinning thoughts.
Breathe when I breathe, Poppy Dennison, whispers Emily.
I shut my eyes and take a deep breath, trying to follow the movement of Emily based on the rise and fall of her fingers, which seemed to press into and through my own.
Forlorn girl with a family lost, someone says, seeking them at any cost.
My heartbeat quickens. It doesn't sound like Emily, and I can't tell whether it's coming from the graveyard around me or from inside my own head. I have to fight not to open my eyes and try to find the source of the voice.
Look for them beyond the veil, past candle dark and shadows pale. Bring them here with spirits bright, then fold them back into the night.
Emily squeezes my hands, and somehow I know to open my eyes. But it isn't Emily kneeling in front of me any longer. It's Aunt Dani. She's just as colorless and translucent as Emily was, though her hair drifts around her as if there's a soft breeze. She scrubbed her face, but she's still wearing the costume dress. Washed-out hearts parade down her skirts.
"Hey, kiddo,"
she says gently. My eyes well with tears as soon as I hear her voice. "Aunt Dani," I say quietly.
"I knew you'd find us,"
she tells me. An unexpected panic hits me as I realize how closely she resembles Emily and Binks. "You're not dead, are you?" She chuckles.
"Please, those old birds can't get rid of me that easily."
"Poppy?"
comes another voice. I look up to Binks, but he's been replaced by my dad, who looks just as pale and translucent as Aunt Dani. He's still wearing the Hollywood headband, which makes me laugh even now.
"No,"
I breathe, the reality of the situation fully sinking in. My body feels waterlogged and my mind slow. I can hear my own heart pounding in my ears.
"Dad, I'm so sorry. I can't. Oh, God, I'm sorry."
I take a deep, shaking breath, the way my mom taught me to do when I feel stressed. It got her through LSATs and the bar exam, she's always said. The thought of her makes me cry harder.
"Where's Mom? Are you sure you're all okay? We're going to get you out of there."
"Your mother went to speak to the manager of this lovely wing of hell," says Aunt Dani.
"She thinks there should be better ventilation,"
says Dad. "She might organize a class action lawsuit against Satan," says Aunt Dani.
"It's unclear."
I laugh again, drying my face with one sleeve. "How do I bring you home?" I ask.
"By undoing the spell,"
he says. "Thanks, Dad. Real helpful.
You and your friends need to send those witches back here before sunrise, okay?"
Dani says, nodding. I meet her eyes, which are a ghostly blue.
"You've got hours left."
"Hours? Great. No pressure," I say with a sigh.
"You're going to be fine," adds Aunt Dani.
But what if we can't do it?" I choke out. I can't imagine a life without Aunt Dani dragging me to Home Depot, or without Dad making popcorn with extra butter just to bribe me into watching some lame old-fashioned music documentary with him, usually one with lots of drumming and saccharine lyrics.
"If we can't help you, will you die?"
"You can help us,"
Aunt Dani says firmly.
"And you will."
I notice she hasn't answered my question.
"You will,"
Dad says.
"Danny's right."
Aunt Dani throws him a satisfied smirk.
"It took us landing in hell for you to say that, jerk face?"
she asks, grinning. Dad ignores her and faces me.
"You're better equipped for this than I ever was."
"But be careful,"
Aunt Dani says with a wink. "Blood moon magic and all." Suddenly, Dad and Aunt Dani look toward the woods. There's a thin, glowing figure coming toward us through the trees. I would recognize that stride, straight and sure, anywhere. Mom opens her arms as she comes near me, and I spring up and run toward her.
"Mom, I'm so sorry," I tell her.
"I know,"
she says,
"but you don't have to be."
Her arms wrap around me, warm and firm.
"Though once we get back,
you're on dish duty every night for the rest of your life."
I laugh, tucking my face into her hair. The warmth of her body fades into something cool and permeable. But when I pull away, I see another woman's face. I break away and stumble back, frightened. The strange ghostly woman is Mom's height, but probably 20 years younger. Her hair is black and curly around a narrow face. Her wide brown eyes are framed with long lashes. Her skin glows dark silver, as if the moonlight has worked itself into her pores, and she wears a pale yellow cloak and dress that flow to her bare feet.
"I'm sorry,"
she says.
"You're not supposed to touch us when we're channeling through the veil."
"Who are you?" I ask, panicked. My whole body feels cold. and I can barely remember the way my mom's arms felt around me just a second ago.
My name is Elizabeth, she says. I woke up when Emily and Thackeray did, but I didn't want to frighten you. I'd like to help you, Poppy Dennison. My sisters can be quite brutal.
Sisters? I ask, suddenly afraid. Wait, you're the ghost of Elizabeth Sanderson? The youngest Sanderson sister, hanged for being a witch after bravely ushering her husband and daughter to safety. I take another step back. She might be a ghost, but what if she still has witchy powers, like Winifred's lightning magic? And what if she is actually evil?
Why are you a ghost if your sisters aren't?
Cuts in Travis. I'm suddenly aware of the cemetery, of Travis, Isabella, and Binks and Emily, who have transformed back into themselves as well.
When one's purpose is incomplete, work left undone has a way of keeping the dead around to return to serve the living,
Elizabeth replies. She looks longingly into the distance.
Perhaps you're my purpose.
Another ghost? A witch ghost,
Travis says faintly, for anyone who might be keeping count.
Four Sanderson sisters.
Isabella watches Elizabeth silently.
Sanderson was my mother's name, Elizabeth says, and my sister's. And yes, mine. I kept it as long as I was alive because I wanted to show that a name doesn't define who you are.
My eyes drop to her throat, which is ringed with a dark, angry bruise.
No, she agrees. It didn't quite work out.
Sisters!
Winifred calls in a haughty, piercing voice that's eerie and out of place in the land of the living.
How wonderful it is to be alive again!
Once we find the Blood Moon Stone, we'll be alive forever, and we'll bring back Mother and Master and all the greats of the beyond.
The trio have stolen a push broom, a rake, and of all things, a barely operational leaf blower from a shed at the local park, and are now soaring over Salem proper. Or, perhaps more accurate, two of them are soaring while Mary sputters along, trying to coax the leaf blower into staying aloft with limited success. Below them, the town lies dark and quiet, with just a few dotted lights pricking the ground like stars.
And look at that moon, Winifred adds. Red as blood, and wide as a bowl of kitten paw soup. Never in my years have I seen something so beautiful. How doth a moon come to look that way, I wonder?
Well, actually,
says Mary, hanging on for dear life as the leaf blower dips and climbs erratically.
A blood moon occurs when the sun passes behind the moon in an eclipse, and the light of the sun is filtered through...
Shut up, you frowsy fopdoodle,
snaps Winifred.
I don't have time for thy dithering.
She pulls a hand-sized rectangle from her pocket.
I want to know what this box is, she says,
sitting up a little straighter to run both of her hands over the smooth surface. The thing suddenly glows with a brilliant white light, and Winifred drops it, startled. Sarah snatches the object from the air and cradles it.
Look, she says. It has an apple on the back, with a bite out of it.
She nibbles on the corner.
It doesn't taste very good.
The face lights up again, and Sarah studies the numbers written there.
It says 11/24 on October 31st, she says. Oh, it is an almanac, Winnie, or a clock without hands.
She tosses it over her shoulder.
Why carry around something so boring?
Mary shoots down to catch the thing just before it hits the ground. When she looks up, she sees Winifred charting a straight course over Salem, while Sarah loops overhead in a wide corkscrew. Sarah's delighted squeals can be heard from 1,000 feet below, where Mary steps lightly off of the leaf blower. She examines the box carefully, and when it lights up again, slides a finger over its screen per its illuminated instructions. Mary jumps when the image changes to that of a beach at sunset, the painting mostly obscured by a grid of circles and squares.
Winnie?
She calls, rocketing back up toward her sisters. She skims alongside Winifred.
I think it's a memory box, or a spell book for thy pocket.
Winifred shakes her head.
A spell book for thy pocket? Why would one ever want a thing like that?
But look, says Mary, pushing on an image at random. A new grid appears, this time with a series of images. A slice of bread with something green, cream of moss slathered on it, and an egg spilling down its side. Some young women in short dresses with smiling faces. Calm water and a sandy beach with patches of tall dune grass. Each is rendered in precise detail and brilliant colors, and each is unlike anything Mary has ever seen. She hands the box back to Winifred.
See?
She says.
Didst thou see?
A memory box, Winifred repeats thoughtfully, without precisely agreeing.
I wonder, sister, would it have a memory of where the blood moonstone is?
She presses the painting Mary showed her, and the image expands as if she's leaned in to look closer. Winifred makes an exasperated noise. Frustrated, she begins tapping everywhere until the box chimes.
How can I help?
Asks a woman's voice. Winifred quirks an intrigued eyebrow at it.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that, says the box.
Winifred clears her throat.
Where is the blood moonstone?
She asks slowly and carefully. The box pauses, then replies.
The Oracle Stone is located at the Oracle Stone, 1416 Central Street, Salem, Massachusetts, 01944.
Sisters,
Winifred says. She guides her push broom in front of Sarah and Mary and gives each of them a light smack across the face. Their giddy smiles turn to determined expressions to match hers. Winifred purses her lips and then grins.
We have someplace to be.
Elizabeth looks down as Emily comes over to tug on the sleeve of her dress. The witch lifts the girl up and perches her on her hip, even though Emily looks far too big to be held.
Are you okay, my little flittermouse?
Elizabeth asks, checking Emily's forehead with the back of her hand.
You were very brave to channel for dear Miss Poppy just now.
Travis clears his throat.
Yeah,
he says.
We're in a bit of a rush to figure out a way to send the Sanderson sisters back. So if you could...
He spins his fingers in a wrap-it-up motion. I elbow him roughly. I assume that manners aren't unique to our spectral plane.
Yes, Elizabeth says apologetically. Quite right.
She sets Emily down.
I've come to help you. I only wish we'd found each other sooner tonight. I would have told you that the first rule of witching is not to trust Winifred's spellbook.
She gives us a commiserating look.
I also learned that the hard way. Once my sisters were hanged, I took up the book to try to bring Emily back from the grave, but it only led a hateful mob right to my doorstep.
Emily rests a tiny hand on her arm. There was nothing you could have done. Travis hugs the spell book close to him.
Well, don't worry. I'll watch it like a hawk.
I mean, I would, but... Dog arms and all, says Isabella.
Thanks, Travis.
Elizabeth, we have to stop your sisters from doing any more harm. And we have to help Isabella turn back into a human and rescue my family, I tell her.
I know, Elizabeth says. There is much to do, and not much time left.
In the pause that follows, every fear I've ever had seems to flash through my mind. Fears of my parents dying, of disappointing them, of never being able to shake that sorrow and guilt. And the witch is doing horrible things to the world, to the town, to me and my friends.
My sisters are conniving. Or at least Winifred is. She'll have already created a plan to complicate matters.
Isabella lets out a high-pitched sigh.
Oh, great! What are we supposed to do now?
When my eyes land on her, I see that she's lain down and placed her two front paws over her face. No one deserves to be trapped in a dog's body, especially not her.
Yeah, what if they find the blood moonstone?
Travis asks.
You must find it first, and I may be able to help you, says Elizabeth. For you see, my mother gave it to me when I married, a moonstone the size of a chicken egg that had been passed through the Sanderson line for centuries. It was always given by a mother to the daughter she believed would use it most responsibly, for that moonstone has two abilities. First, if boiled in a pot of river water and herbs, it makes a broth that will grant eternal life. Second, if the stone is broken, so too is every spell cast by a Sanderson.
I glance over at Travis, and his expression says, "Yeah, that's pertinent information to know." Then I turn to Isabella. She's perked up. Even her ears seem taller.
"Every spell?"
she asks Elizabeth.
"Any of them still in force," says Elizabeth. "You would go back to Two Legs."
She looks at me.
"And your parents and aunt would return from the world beyond the veil."
"But I cast the spell, not Isabella," I say.
"You read the spell," Elizabeth agrees. "But the three of you cast it together."
"Do you remember where the moonstone is?" Isabella asks. "We have to find it and destroy it before Winifred gets her hands on it."
"How do we destroy a blood moonstone?" I ask. "Nuke it in the microwave?"
"Microwave?"
Elizabeth asks.
"Forget it," I say.
Elizabeth shakes her head.
"I feared my sisters would find it, so I gave it to my husband to look after. And I asked him to never tell another living soul where he hid it. And then, the day after my sisters were hanged, I knew the town would come for me and my family next, so I prepared everything for a hasty exit. We nearly made it, too. But as my husband Jacob and I made to leave, they came for us with pitchforks and torches. I only just bought Jacob and our daughter Ismay enough time to escape to the woods. I never saw them or the moonstone again."
She looks at Isabella.
"That stone is tied to the Sanderson family, and the Sanderson family is in your blood. You can cast a spell to find it."
"Am I the only one who thinks this sounds like, I don't know, the worst possible idea we could think of?"
asks Travis.
"Magic got us into this mess in the first place."
Elizabeth rests a hand on his shoulder. "And only magic can get you out."
Cell binding. The Sanderson sisters land in the middle of the deserted street, heels clicking on pavement as they cross to a squat, unlit building with plate glass windows and a hand-lettered sign reading, "The Oracle Stone." Beneath it, a second, smaller sign reads, "Crystals, incense, talismans, and texts." While Winifred stalks up to the shop to let herself in, Mary finds her attention drawn by the shop next door. A banner hangs in the front window with a series of pictures of women and men laughing as they press different versions of the strange memory box to their cheeks. The text along the bottom of the banner reads, "Your contacts, our network, connect more." Mary looks at the object in her hands doubtfully and presses the buttons again until she finds an outline of a head and torso. Beneath the image is the word contacts. She presses it, and a long list of names appears. Chewing her lip, Mary follows Winifred to the front of the Oracle Stone. A group of three men in costumes come staggering down the street, laughing loudly. One has his arms draped around the shoulders of the other two. He looks, Winifred thinks, as if he's been too long in the brewer's cold cellar.
"Excuse me, good sir."
Sarah puts a hand on the arm of the man in the middle. He has high cheekbones and a perfect smile. She squeezes his forearm with barely masked excitement.
"Could you help a lady in need?"
The group swivels to face the witches.
"Oh my God!"
the middle one balks, straightening when he spots them.
"The Sanderson sisters!"
Sarah's sisters peer around her shoulder at the man, and he gives a shriek of laughter. His friends are beaming, too. He extracts his arms from around their shoulders, but stumbles backward.
"You ladies look fab,"
he says.
"Can I get a selfie?"
Winifred looks at her sisters, perturbed and uncertain.
"A what?" "A selfie,"
he repeats.
"I'll be quick."
He hiccups, then shakes his head as if trying to knock some sense back into himself.
"Okay, let's work it."
He pulls out a box that resembles the one in Mary's hand. He poses in front of the confused sisters. And when the box lights up with a brilliant white burst, they shriek and jump back. The man laughs.
You ladies are so spot on. I love it.
His curls all seem to gather at the top of his head, spilling down a little over his forehead. He combs them back with his fingers and slings his arms back around his friends.
And you are so drunk,
one friend grunts at him, giving the sisters an apologetic smile.
Night, ladies.
We have need to enter this shop, says Winifred.
She points at the dark locked door of the Oracle Stone.
They're open tomorrow,
he says, nodding at a sign with the store's hours.
But come early. It'll be packed the rest of the weekend for post-Halloween sales.
The three men wander off, the stumbling one in the middle shouting,
I put a spell on you and now you're mine! Mine, mine, mine!
As they veer off down a pedestrian alley. Winifred watches them go.
Hooligans, she mutters.
Beautiful hooligans,
Sarah agrees dreamily. Winifred turns back to the shop and zaps the brass handle with a quick bolt of lightning. She thunders into the store and looks around, skirts billowing around her.
It isn't here, she exclaims, voice shaking. That memory box lied to us.
The shop smells musty and spicy, especially near one table where candles sit next to carefully arranged bundles of dried herbs and baskets of sticks that exude the scents of earth and tumbled leaves. There are shelves of books on spirituality and the occult, each section propped up by bookends made from huge agates, their polished faces rippling with bands of color. There are jewelry displays shining with polished stones and burnished metals. Sarah claps her hands, plucking up a necklace of huge black pearls surrounding an even larger purple gemstone.
Winnie,
Mary ventures.
The box. I believe it summons.
I will not trust that blasted chattering box again, snaps Winifred. Sarah, come. We'll find the house of that traitorous bottom dweller of a sister, and we'll turn it inside out.
But Winnie,
Mary says, following her sisters to the shop door.
It's been 300 years. What if her house does not stand there any?
Winifred whirls around and bears down upon her.
And 300 years later, our own house stands the same, does it not, Mary?
Yes,
Mary yelps.
Well, except that everything is broken now, thanks to...
Enough,
Winifred says, sniffing with disgust. She turns on her heel and heads back to the front of the store.
Enough, enough, enough,
chimes Sarah, stomping her boots and twirling her skirts.
But what if Sarah could call the children through the box?
Mary blurts. Winifred freezes, unused to being challenged by either of her sisters.
Sarah can already call the children, you dal cop.
Yes, if they can hear her,
Mary says quickly, trying to fit all her words into one breath.
But what about the ones who were too far away to...
In the background, an oblivious Sarah slips a ring onto her finger and holds it up to the window, examining the shine.
Go on, Mary,
says Winifred with disdain, turning and stepping toward her brunette sister.
What if I am wrong, and thou art not wrong? Is this thy meaning,
Yes, I mean no, I mean of course not,
Mary says, quailing under her sister's stormy gaze. Winifred leaves the shop, snatching at Sarah's wrist as she passes her.
Our brooms, they're gone,
Winifred calls out. Sarah stumbles after her, throwing Mary an apologetic look.
We shall find more brooms,
Sarah replies cheerily. Mary turns away with a sigh. She sees a piece of fool's gold, pyrite, her mother called it, and runs one finger along its rough ribs. She still remembers the day she found a piece of this at the age of 6 and told Winnie she'd made them all rich. Winnie, with a superiority of several years and her own mistakes, replied that Mary was a stupid, gullible girl. Mary picks up the worthless stone and examines it in the thin moonlight,
I'm always just the sister on the outside, Mary sings softly. I'm always just the sister without a ride.
She pauses to swallow a sob. She sucks her lips into her mouth, steadying herself, then opens her hand to see the stone again. After a moment, she turns toward the open front door and continues to sing,
I can't see past that look inside your eye.
Around her, gemstones float slowly into the air, catching the light of street lamps filtering through the front windows.
I can't tell what you're scheming of tonight.
Her voice lifts higher, stronger.
I don't know where I've done you wrong, but I'm not slow.
Mary strides toward the door with more determination.
Oh, this ain't love. Oh, Winnie, I know.
Mary swings onto the street, but her sisters are nowhere in sight. A trail of gemstones follows her out, sparkling and crisscrossing as she twirls down the street by herself, her voice gaining confidence.
Ever since your first words and your first hex, long before your powers and your projects, you always thought you're better than me. You're top dog and I'm the flea.
She freezes in front of a secondhand store, checking her reflection in a standing mirror on display.
But that's not true. The world's not for you, she insists, spinning away. You're not in charge. The world's always been ours. I don't know where I've done you wrong, but I'm not slow. Oh, this ain't love. Oh, Winnie, I know.
As Mary passes Dot's music store, a trumpet in the window floats up and plays a soulful riff. Its sound muffled by the thick glass like a 1930s jazz intro. A narrow drum sidles up to it, sticks rapping in time with Mary's sashaying footsteps.
Oh, Winnie, I know. Winnie, I know.
She belts out, arms spread wide to take up all the space she can. The musical instruments burst through the plate glass store window and trail her down the walk.
Tonight, I'm doing everything. I'll show you who I'm meant to be. Tonight, I'll prove that I'm worth your time. I'm full of witchy energy. I don't care what you've got planned or if it's grand. Oh, this ain't love. Oh, I ain't slow. Oh, Winnie, I know.
She spins around, pirouetting in the warm light of the moon, and frolics down a row of huge houses, throwing her arms out as she dances, her toes barely touching the ground.
You might not want it to be true, Winnie, but I'm more than what you see in me, Winnie.
The freedom is intoxicating. And the gemstones and musical instruments form her own glittering entourage.
Tonight, before sunrise, I'll push back on your lies. And I'll be more than a bore. Oh, so much more than you thought I could be, Winnie. Oh, this ain't love. Oh, Winnie, I know. I'm taking a stand. Tonight's the Mary show.
She ends with a dramatic flourish, chest heaving. Beside her, someone clears her throat impatiently. Mary pivots, stones and instruments crashing down on the pavement. Winifred watches her with distaste, two red eyebrows arched almost as high as her hairline.
Art thou quite finished?
Mary draws her limbs close to her body and smooths her skirt self-consciously.
Yes, Winnie. Sorry, Winnie,
she says, watching her feet.
Good.
Says her sister crisply.
I have a plan.
The three sisters hurry through the picket fence surrounding a beautiful white house, one of the few homes on the block whose lights are still on. Inside, a handful of teenagers in costumes dance to loud music. Another group is sprawled on a selection of chairs and couches. There's a cauldron on a table near the door, and Sarah hurries over to it, picking up one of the items inside, which is wrapped in a crinkling, brightly colored paper. She peels open the wrapper and tastes the contents with the very tip of her tongue.
Chocolate,
she says, and then spits, throwing the thing down. She goes to grab an item with a different wrapper on a platter of frosted cookies. But as she's bringing the salmon-colored thing to her mouth, Winifred elbows her in the stomach. Sarah gasps as she drops the candy and clutches her middle.
Get to work,
says Winifred. With a huff, Sarah pulls the talking box from the depths of her skirts and goes to the nearest young man, who is dressed in a black cape with blood spattered down his unbuttoned white shirt.
"Well met, good sir,"
she says, batting her eyelashes and giving him a warm smile.
Hi,
he says around pointed plastic teeth, trying very hard not to look at her low-cut bodice. She shows him the box, which is balanced daintily on the tips of her fingers.
"Wouldst thou explain to me how this contraption works?"
Behind her, Mary chews her lip nervously as Winifred grins.
"So you're saying we need a fragment of bone?" I ask Elizabeth.
My eyes flit behind her to Travis, who is talking in a low voice to Binks and Emily. My phone buzzes to life with an incoming call, interrupting us. I pull it out of my pocket and look at Isabella.
Where's your phone?
Isabella blinks and tilts her head.
My phone got left behind in my peacoat when they turned me into this magnificent creature.
Well, you're calling me.
What? I don't even have opposable thumbs, she retorts.
I turn my phone down to show her.
Poppy, where's that photo from? She asks. I like it. I didn't know you took it.
I turn my phone back to me and see the visual that pops up when she calls. It's a shot of her in a woolly sweater at the beach, gazing out over Salem Harbor with this beautiful, faraway look on her face. I took it shortly after the start of the school year.
And I thought you didn't like taking photos on phones,
says Isabella teasingly.
It's convenient,
I say, trying to shrug it off, but she can probably tell I'm embarrassed.
It's okay, she says. It's a nice picture. I'm glad you took it.
Blushing, I answer the call and press the phone against my ear, grateful to stop that conversation in its tracks.
Hello?
I ask.
Poppy, that might not be...
Isabella's voice fades out of my range of hearing, like a car radio spun down to low. The world takes on a milky hue, as if the light reflecting off leaves and blades of grass has a blurry filter on it. The thoughts in my head slow and spiral, and all I can think about is the beauty of the song looping through my brain.
Come, little children, I'll take thee away.
I've never tasted words before, but these words taste like buttercream frosting. I look at Isabella, whose black and white face is pressed close to mine, and I realize I've collapsed onto my back in the grass, though I don't remember when I did that. She looks concerned, and I hear a distant whimper that seems filtered through layers and layers of cotton balls. Suddenly, the idea that Isabella could be trapped as a dog forever seems impossible. And my parents? My parents will be fine.
Maybe hell's even a welcome break for them. Nothing to do, no pressure. It sounds nice. Besides, the witches just wanted some time to enjoy Halloween night. And don't we all, really? Anyway, I have a blood moonstone to track down for Sarah. And where's the spell book? We have it, don't we?
I look at my friends.
No. My enemies?
Isabella whimpers again. And I want to share this song with her to help her understand the mission. I want to share this song with everyone. I could dive in and swim through its warm, slow waves of dark chocolate and cinnamon. I think I will. The phone is ripped out of my hand and the voice disappears, leaving me with an aching sense of loss.
Why did you do that?
I shout at Travis, who has ended the call and taken away all the comfort that came with it.
Give it back!
He looks at me with wide eyes and shakes his head.
No phone for Poppy.
Elizabeth crouches beside me, taking both of my hands in hers.
That was the voice of my sister Sarah, she says. I'd know it anywhere. But how did she speak to you through that thing?
My thoughts are fuzzy and running slow, and I'm not sure how to answer. Elizabeth seems to notice. She touches my cheek, and the chill of her fingers spills over my face and down my neck. I shiver, and when I do, the last of the song's effects seem to vanish.
Sarah has a gift,
Elizabeth adds.
But all her life, she's used it selfishly.
Travis's phone rings then, and we both turn to look at him.
Isabella,
he says, showing us the screen, where there's another incoming call from Isabella Richards.
They took your phone and they're working through your contacts, I say to Isabella.
My recent calls, she agrees.
Oh no, my mom, my dad.
I'm sure they're okay, I say, trying my best to sound reassuring.
Isabella nods.
Can't think about that right now. How did they get it to work?
There's a lesson about locked screens in here, says Travis, rejecting the call with a quick swipe of his thumb.
The three ghosts are looking from each of us to the next, clearly puzzled.
These phones allow you to talk to people far away, explains Isabella. You can even send written notes and photos.
When Binks knits his brow, Isabella hesitates.
Photographs. Sorry. I forgot they weren't around when you...
She breaks off.
Never mind. The point is, Sarah is calling people I know and trying to cast a spell on them. But I don't understand why.
Poppy, didn't you say that last time they flew over Salem to cast a spell on everyone? Doing it one by one? Isn't that slower?
I don't know. Hearing it made me want to sing it to all of you.
Maybe it's like some game of telephone, but with her spell, I say, looking to Travis.
It's a good thing you didn't let her finish. I shake my head.
Perhaps, says Elizabeth, but if Winifred is involved, there is some other scheme in play. You must find that moonstone, Isabella, or my sisters surely will. Find it and destroy it.
Isabella nods.
Show us how to cast that spell you were telling us about earlier.
Well, as I was saying, says Elizabeth, we must first find a fragment of bone, along with the fruit of the earth, leaves deceased, and a bed of soil.
She studies Isabella for another long moment.
You're going to make a great witch one day, you know. You've already got the cunning and bravery.
She smiles.
It's a good thing, too. You're going to need them both.
Travis and I scour the dark woods for holly berries, while Isabella scratches in a clearing that's well away from any fresh graves. Emily and Binks help by picking through the freshly turned dirt, pulling out any leaves and bits of grass that might stifle the spell. Isabella reappears after a few minutes with a sharp splinter of bone in her mouth.
Where did you find that?
Asks Travis, eyeing it.
Actually, you know what? Forget I asked.
I put the berries in a heap at the center of the dirt circle, and Elizabeth sets the bone down beside them. Travis takes a handful of dead leaves and twigs and adds them on the other side of the bone.
You'll need to add a piece of yourself to it, Elizabeth says. Winnie would recommend blood, but I think that's a bit too morbid, don't you?
I've been shedding, says Isabella, shaking her whole body like a dog trying to air dry.
Will that work?
We shall see, says Elizabeth.
I stoop and pick up a short stray hair of hers from the ground, then add it to the pile of items.
My mother taught me a spell after she gave me the moonstone, so that I might always be able to find it should I ever lose it. But she made me swear never to tell Winifred or the others. It's not in the book, says Elizabeth.
She then leans down and whispers directions to Isabella, who repeats the spell in a strong, clear voice.
Blood of family, blood of stone. Over, under, backward roam. On mountain high, in graveyard deep, show me where the moonstone sleeps.
The leaves and twigs rearrange, sketching a map that turns piled foliage into hills and valleys, and drawing lines that might be borders or roads. The berries roll, too, clustering along one winding line of bare, wet earth.
Those are buildings, Elizabeth says, leaning down and pointing at each berry. The chapel, the milliner's house, mine.
A lone berry tumbles far away from the others and nestles into a soft bit of earth.
That's my childhood home. And this one was the Binks' house.
She looks up at Emily.
Do you remember, Poppet?
The girl nods solemnly. Then a sad smile breaks over her face. The bone is beginning to tumble now, too, end over end, until it reaches an outcropping of leaf land bordered on three sides by damp soil. It digs itself into the lower right side, like a particularly